From KUNC, this is Colorado Edition. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. It's Wednesday, August 14th. Thanks for joining us. Today on the show, a chemical depot in Pueblo is dismantling chemical weapons.
Plus, efforts to clean up abandoned oil and gas wells in the state.
So we are not completely sure what's in them until we start pulling it out.
That's coming up on Colorado Edition.
In these last weeks of summer, the beautiful weather means more people are taking to the roads on motorcycles, bikes, and scooters. But it's not always safe.
That's right. The first fatality involving an electric scooter was reported earlier this month in Denver. E-scooters were introduced in the city last June.
And it's also been a deadly year for motorcyclists. So far, 66 riders have died on Colorado roads. Last year, that number was 103. That led Governor Jared Polis to proclaim August 12th Colorado Motorcyclist Memorial Day, a first. Joining us now to discuss how to get where you're going safely is Sam Cole. He's the communications manager for the Colorado Department of Transportation. Sam, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, what do these numbers tell us about motorcycle safety?
Well, unfortunately, our roadways can be very dangerous for motorcyclists. You know, it goes without saying that they don't have any crash protection or very little crash protection. So that leads to an uptick in motorcycle fatalities on our roadways. And they can be very difficult to see. You know, they occupy a very small footprint on our roadways. And often drivers miss seeing them, and sometimes with tragic consequences.
And in that light, what advice do you have for motorcyclists to stay safe out on the roads?
Well, for motorcyclists, it's really important that they get trained, that they wear proper gear, including helmets, that they get a license endorsement. Those are the best ways to stay safe and ride, obviously, very defensively.
And what about for drivers of autos?
Well, for drivers, it's so important that you leave plenty of space whenever you're following a motorcyclist. Also, always check your blind spots twice. As I mentioned, you know, motorcyclists can be hard to see. We see most crashes involving motorcyclists when drivers pull out onto a roadway and just entirely miss seeing that motorcyclist that's coming down the roadway and ends up crashing. And the other thing that drivers can do just to stay safe is always check their blind spots a couple times, because whether you're a motorcyclist or even a bicyclist, you can get lost in a blind spot. The average blind spot on a vehicle is 650 square feet. You know, you can literally put a jet plane in somebody's blind spot.
Sam Cole is with the Colorado Department of Transportation. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're so welcome, Erin. Thank you.
CDOT has also reported 10 bicycle deaths this year. For more on how cyclists can keep themselves safe, we reached out to Maureen McKenna, the Education Program Manager for Bicycle Colorado.
First, we like to remind bicyclists that bicycles are a vehicle by law, by Colorado state statute. So reminding them of bicyclists of their responsibility to follow all signs and signals on the road, following the flow of traffic, following right of way, and pretty much anything that you would do as a motorist behind the wheel. But at the same time, we like to point out the different characteristics that bicyclists have from a motorist. So the fact that they are more vulnerable, they are more exposed, they are lighter weight, and oftentimes that leads us to encourage them to become or to be defensive when they're riding their bikes and making sure that they're aware of their surroundings and doing what they need to keep themselves safe, because sadly, everyone on the road may not be looking out for them, or smaller road users or smaller vehicles on the road.
She also said that even though reflective gear isn't required in Colorado, it's another option for cyclists who want to increase their visibility.
Coming up, we'll get the story on a long-abandoned piece of land along Highway 36 that may finally be developed. But before we get to that, here's a look at some of the news you may have missed today. A new poll finds most Coloradans would approve a measure to let the state keep excess revenue that it would otherwise have to return to taxpayers. The survey was conducted by Republican firm Magellan Strategies. It found 54% would approve Proposition CC, while 30% would vote against it.
The measure was referred to the ballot by lawmakers. It would allow the state to keep Tabor refunds and spend the money on education and transportation. The survey of 500 likely voters in the 2020 election had a margin of error of plus or minus 4 percentage points. Bears have been making the news this summer for making their way into some of the state's residential areas. Around Estes Park, for example, Colorado Parks and Wildlife says bears have broken into 35 vehicles and 9 homes over a period in late July and early August. Rebecca Farrell from Parks and Wildlife says residents need to lock doors and windows and bear-proof their trash.
You know, if you're providing an easy meal, a bear is definitely going to be able to smell it, and if they get it once, the odds are very high that they'll come back.
Bears will be on the prowl for food late into the year when winter weather starts.
Longmont's defunct ban on hydraulic fracturing may see another day in court. The environmental group Colorado Rising has filed a motion to reinstate it. Longmont voters originally passed the ban in 2012, but it was struck down as unconstitutional. Colorado Rising attorney Joe Salazar says the passage of Senate Bill 181 this year gives local governments the power to impose these types of bans on oil and gas drilling.
So that way the city of Longmont can finally enforce the voter-approved charter amendment.
The motion filed in Boulder County District Court is the first of many steps needed to revive the city's short-lived ban.
And speaking of the oil industry, there are hundreds of abandoned oil and gas wells scattered across Colorado. Some are harmless. Others are so old they're leaking, posing a threat to nearby neighborhoods. That's why in one of his last actions as governor, John Hickenlooper set a deadline to plug most of the state's so-called orphan wells by 2023.
This executive order is one example of really trying to do everything we can to preserve quality of life and, you know, what really defines our appreciation and affection for Colorado.
To better understand why it takes so long to plug these wells and if the state is going to meet the goal, KUNC's Matt Bloom visited a crew in Adams County.
Plugging just one of the 275 wells on the state's list can take more than a week, and that's not counting months of paperwork that needs to be done leading up to the actual job. By the time it's over, it can cost upwards of $80,000.
Check, 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 1, 2, 3.
I pull up to the well site near Brighton on a Thursday morning, just as workers are getting started for the day. A man in a white hard hat jogs towards my car.
Mike!
Good to meet you finally.
Good to meet you. How's it going?
Good.
Mike Hickey is an engineer with the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission's Orphan Well Unit.
You just stay within arm's reach of me. I've got a gas meter on and...
As we walk towards the well, I ask him how it got orphaned in the first place.
It was, you know, kind of a sad story. The sole proprietor got really sick.
Because of that, Hickey says the family-run Canadian company basically stopped taking care of it, and the violations racked up.
So the final hearing, they said, you know, your license to operate in the state is revoked. And as soon as that happens, it becomes an orphan, doesn't have an operator anymore.
That was 3 years ago. Since then, the COGCC has taken control and classified it as a high priority for plugging, meaning it's a danger to new homes that are being built nearby.
This is one of the first times I've been out here when you couldn't hear roofing hammers going on in all sides.
On the surface, the well looks small, a couple feet of dirty pipe jutting out of the ground with rusted valves and meters, but it's about a mile deep underground.
And this is an awesome vantage point.
The crew starts by removing the inner workings of the well, what are called rods. They use a drill rig to yank the long, thin pieces out one by one. With this well, Hickey says they're kind of playing it by ear.
We never operated these wells, so we are not completely sure what's in them until we start pulling it out.
But then something makes the crew stop.
Something made them go, ooh.
Hickey runs over to see what's wrong. After a minute, he waves me over.
You can see all the goo on these. It's getting worse.
He's pointing to a black material dripping off some of the rods.
They can't drive down the highway with this. It's not allowed. It's too messy.
It's called paraffin. It's a substance that gloms onto the inside of wells after years of neglect. They now need to call in a special truck called a hot oiler to clean it.
Hi, Bill. My name is Mike Hickey, 970.
We wait an hour, but no luck.
Looks like we may be shut down till morning.
Really?
Yeah.
Which they did. So I came back the next morning.
No, they're all cleaned up.
The crew got a hot oiler to come by first thing to pump water down the well. Now they're back at it.
There's the rods, and then there's the tubing, and then there's the casing. And yeah, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it.
This will likely take the entire day. In the meantime, Hickey shows me the plug.
And we're looking at this. It kind of looks like a thermos, you know?
Yeah.
I know it's not that, but it's just a tube.
About a foot long. Not even a foot long, maybe 10, 11 inches long.
The plug is then attached to the end of a long metal pipe, which is packed with explosives. Once the well is cleared of its inner rods, they'll lower it underground, detonate it, and seal the cracks with cement. They'll repeat the process 4 more times at various depths. As the 7-man crew takes a break, I learn that they're from Rangeley, a small town on the western slope. The state contracts them to do several wells at a time.
This is actually, in my opinion, some of the better work, especially for the state. It's clean cut, laid out. There's no guessing.
Dusty Daniels is their manager. He brings his Irish Terrier Chip Daniels along to every site.
Who's this guy?
He's a rescue dog.
Combined, they've plugged about 24 orphaned wells in the past 3 or 4 years, and he hopes they can do more.
Just show up, and everything's supposed to be smooth, and 90% of the time it goes like it's supposed to.
For the most part, the rest of the day does go smoothly. The temperature hits 101 degrees, though, which slows things down. But Mike Hickey's crew doesn't stop.
Peyton Manning made the NFL look easy. Some of these guys are really good at what they do.
And unlike me, they work right through the weekend. I don't check back in until Monday.
Snapped a picture of the rig this morning because there was hot air balloons in the background.
Oh, nice.
Mike Hickey says they detonated the first plug early Saturday. That one was a mile down. They set another at 2,500 feet. Now, they're putting a third plug in at 1,500 feet, just below an aquifer to protect the water. It might seem excessive, but Hickey says there's a reason.
Most people are thinking in the 20-year time frame. We think 1,000-year plugs.
1,000-year.
1,000-year plugs, or really, 10,000-year plugs. These have to be permanent.
I ask him if he thinks there will ever be a day when the state doesn't need to clean up after oil and gas operators. He says he's optimistic.
Most of the well plugging that goes on in this state is operators plugging their own wells. These are by far a minority compared to the guys who are doing it right.
So they're lifting what looks like the last bit of the well out of the ground.
After almost a week, this well is nearly plugged. After the aquifer protection plug is set, there are just a few more steps.
And then we cut it off 4 feet down, weld a cap on it, put identifying information on that cap, bury it, and sweep the floor.
It's a job well done.
Hickey hopes people understand that while slow, every step of the process is important. So with that in mind, what's it going to take to stay on track with the 2023 deadline?
Let me check that.
Dave Andrews is the manager of the COGCC's Orphan Well Program. I called him after I left the well site.
Our goal is actually 38.
That's 38 wells a year. But the current backlog of wells is 275. So if you do the math, it'll take about 7 years to finish the job.
I don't think we're in a position where it's going to be easily obtainable. I mean, we're definitely going to be pushing hard to get to that point.
Andrew says they're exploring new ways to help move things along faster. Matt Bloom, KUNC, Adams County.
Now let's turn to another abandoned place that may see some development.
Right. It's not every day that people look forward to development, but in Louisville, Colorado, residents are on pins and needles waiting for an announcement about the future of a long-abandoned 432-acre site off Highway 36. Lucas High, a reporter for Biz West, has been following the history of the land. Lucas, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thanks, Henry. It's good to talk to you.
In 2008, ConocoPhillips, the oil and gas company, acquired the land for about $55 million. What were they planning on doing with it?
At the time, ConocoPhillips had this grand plan where they're going to create a clean energy research complex that ultimately would have created something around 7,000 jobs. But ConocoPhillips actually kind of spun off a company called Phillips 66 into a different company and kind of abandoned their plans for the Louisville Clean Energy Research Complex. And it's basically sat dormant since, 2006-ish. So it's been, 12, 13 years now.
And so it's mostly been kind of unused in that period. But I understand that, like, back when Amazon was looking for a spot to open its second headquarters, this was pitched as a possible location?
Yeah. And so the interesting thing about this property is that despite it being dormant for all these years, it's really prime real estate. It's not every day that you have 400 plus acres on U.S. Highway 36 near Northwest Parkway, smack dab between Boulder and Denver, that is available to develop. So yeah, when Amazon was looking for a new site for its HQ2 project, That was one of eight sites in the Metro Denver area that were submitted for that. I mean, obviously, Denver did not get the project and it's going to be built in Virginia. But I think the fact that it was even being considered as a possibility is indicative of, you know, the importance of this site as far as, you know, development potential goes.
Why are people talking about this now?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to take you on a little bit more of a kind of a history lesson here. So there were some plans by a real estate investment company called Bancroft Capital to buy the property in 2018 for $500 million. That was around the time during the Amazon HQ2 discussions. That deal ended up falling through. However, in late June, kind of out of nowhere, we'd been wondering what was going on with that project because, you know, we hadn't heard anything much about it since 2018. But in late June, a development and real estate investment company out of Denver called Brew Bacall Capital Partners submitted a bunch of plans to the city of Louisville to take another stab at redeveloping it. And, you know, those plans are pretty significant. They call for the construction of a 500,000 square foot corporate campus that could eventually employ up to 2,500 people, 3.4 million square feet of office space, retail spaces, hotels, more than 1,000 units of senior living housing. And, you know, it's really interesting because the documents that have been submitted by this developer to the city indicate that there has been a, quote, large organization, unquote, that's identified the site as an opportunity for a new corporate headquarters. So if these plans ultimately come to fruition, Louisville may be the new headquarters city for some major company or major organization. It's still sort of a mystery as to what that organization might be, but there's certainly some potential there.
Interesting. So do you have an idea of when we might learn those things or kind of what the next steps are in development?
Sure, absolutely. Well, I can't say for sure when we will learn the specifics about what companies might be interested in building a corporate campus there. However, the community will actually have a chance to learn more about the project next Monday. The developers are hosting a community information meeting. It starts at 6 o'clock on Monday, August 19th, and it's going to be at the Louisville Recreation and Senior Center. So I believe they'll be, you know, accepting input from residents on issues like open space and transportation. And then following that, there's a tentative plan in September for Rubicall's development plans to be reviewed by Louisville's Planning Commission, which will be another opportunity for the community to provide their input and learn a little bit more about the project.
Lucas, hi. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Henry. I appreciate it.
An Army depot in Pueblo has long been home to a toxic legacy. Hundreds of thousands of chemical weapons capable of killing or debilitating troops by blistering their skin or blinding them. The weapons have been stockpiled at the depot for generations, and under international treaty, they must be destroyed. Health and environmental concerns have long delayed that effort. But now, as KUNC's Michael DeJuana reports, shells filled with mustard gas are finally disappearing.
During World War II, the U.S. military assembled a special group of soldiers who were preparing to use chemical weapons if the Nazis used them first.
The big day is still to come. It'll be when Hitler, with his back to the wall, frantically uses gas as a last resort. That will be the climax in this war, and depending upon what happens then, may rest the outcome.
This military training film was restricted when it was released in the 1940s. Meaning it was never seen by the public. It was produced before there was an atomic bomb, back when the worst kind of war imaginable involved chemical weapons.
When the gas warfare phase comes, it will produce tremendous casualties on the enemy, and at the same time prevent excessive casualties to our own troops.
The film also highlights a vast network of chemical weapons labs and manufacturing arsenals working on the effort.
Here on the outskirts of Denver, Colorado, is the newest of our arsenals, the Rocky Mountain Chemical Warfare Arsenal. It is located completely out of the range of any possible air threat.
The weapons made in this era and in subsequent years were sent to various depots around the country, including one about 100 miles south of Denver, in Pueblo, the Army's Pueblo Chemical Depot, where they've sat for about seven decades. By international treaty, workers are disassembling 780,000 shells and mortars.
There's chemical agent in there. There's decontamination solution in there, a vapor hazard, a liquid hazard.
It'll kill you.
That's Tom Bailey. He's a support specialist at the heavily guarded Pueblo Chemical Agent Destruction Pilot Plant, one of just two Army sites in the U.S. contending with such chemical weapons. He shows me the protective suit the workers wear. It looks like a spacesuit. It has a tube for air and a pulse display for workers and the operators that watch their every move from a control room.
Yeah. It's 30 mil polyvinyl chloride, so you can feel it's real heavy.
The work is so technical and so dangerous that I can't go to the actual site. So I'm visiting a nearby training facility, a life-size replica, only there's no mustard agent to worry about. Inside, there are two robots, and they're named for characters in the classic 1970s Mel Brooks film, Young Frankenstein. One is Inga, and...
Who was Inga's assistant with young Dr. Frankenstein?
Well, I'm thinking Igor, or is it Igor?
Igor. You nailed it.
And that's about as funny as things get around here. The robots cut open the tops of the shells, remove the bursters that would make them explode, and then comes the really tricky part. Some are corroded on the inside, and as a byproduct, hydrogen gas can mingle with the mustard agent.
It's in the liquid.
Okay.
Just like champagne.
Wow.
Okay? What happens when you open a champagne bottle? What happens when you break that seal at the top? Right? All those bubbles break.
Right.
And when they do, then that...
cascades out.
It expands. That the liquid becomes foam, and it expands to where it wants.
Igor delicately moves a roughly 100-pound shell upside down at a kind of sink. If the gallon of liquid inside were to start bubbling, this method could handle it. A machine then sprays high-pressure hot water into the shell, coaxing what's in it out. Then Igor picks the shell up.
He's going to hold it at 30 degrees for about 10 seconds to allow things to drain.
What's left of the shells goes one way, to an oven, where it's superheated, burning off any remaining mustard. From there, the steel is recycled. As for the liquid, it flows down a drain and then through titanium pipes in a closed system. From there...
Wastewater treatment 101.
Site project manager Walton Levi, who runs the plant, says the water starts to break down the mustard agent. And eventually, it goes to a reactor where it's neutralized. It turns into what's called thiodiglycol. And as odd as this sounds, the same kind of microbes that are used in sewage systems to consume human waste also eat this stuff.
It's Darwin at its best. So those microbes that really like the thiodiglycol and can digest it the best, they multiply and take over.
What is the byproduct of that?
It is mostly water and salt.
But this isn't the kind of salt you would want to put on your eggs in the morning.
No. It's kind of a slurry solution coming out. It's kind of a wet salt.
The water is then pressed out of that salt and reused at the plant. And the salt cakes that are left are contaminated with heavy metals.
So you'll see these salt cakes go off to hazardous waste landfill.
It's taken more than a decade to get to this point. From conception of the plant starting in 2004 to construction starting in 2008 to testing, and finally the destruction of the first few of the depot's weapons in September of 2016. By law, all 780,000 shells must be destroyed by the end of 2023. Levi wants that to happen a full year ahead of the deadline.
We want to make sure we target early as a contingency so we'll hit that December 2023 date.
Because there can be delays. Earlier this year, plant operations were halted when two large tanks that store the thiodiglycol developed leaks.
Between the two tanks, it was a total of 8 ounces. We are very vigilant. Safety is everything we do.
How long were operations down when that happened?
They were down about 3 to 4 weeks.
On July 31st, the plant hit a milestone, processing 150,000 of the largest shells at a rate of 24 per hour, which it has agreed to with the state. The plant could go faster.
A total of 64 an hour.
But that might be too fast. to find the most sustainable rate. The plant is working with the state.
The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment will set the limit as to how many weapons per day they are allowed to put through.
Irene Cornelli is a locally appointed member of the Colorado Chemical Demilitarization Citizens Advisory Commission. It's a group that monitors every aspect of the destruction of the weapons, giving voice to the community.
They have to go through a pretty massive process called a multi-pathway health risk assessment of everything that comes out of the plant. Does it still meet air quality standards? Does it still meet all the standards that we're looking for?
All of this effort was created a generation ago as an alternative to how the Army used to destroy chemical weapons. First, by dropping them into the sea, and when that fell under scrutiny, by incinerating them at installations. When the work at Pueblo's Army Depot and another depot in Kentucky is finally done, the United States will be rid of its chemical weapons, honoring its commitment to the international community. They were manufactured long ago for a nightmare battle that never happened. Michael DeOanna, KUNC, Pueblo.
You can go more in-depth with Michael's reporting at our website, KUNC.org.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk with the founder of the Leadville 100.
Plus, we'll look into the black market for marijuana, still thriving in Colorado 7 years after legalization.
Now, if you have something you're curious about, we'd love to look into it. Send your questions using Curious Colorado on our homepage, KUNC.org. This episode was produced by Lily Tyson and hosted by me, Erin O'Toole.
And me, Henry Zimmerman. Ryan Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow with another episode of Colorado Edition.